Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Visit audiblepodcast.com/auctionpodcast for your free audiobook download.
Everyone, this is Martin Willis from the Antique Auction Podcast Show. Phyllis is off in Napa somewhere, so it's just me here alone today. I do have some special guests coming up, and our topic is about needlework samplers. And I've always thought there was something really sweet and sentimental about needlework samplers, and they're like artwork, and you hardly ever see any two alike. It's pretty amazing, and you think about all the hands that touch these. So many years ago. It's quite fascinating. And our two great guests with us today are Stephen and Carol Huber. Welcome, Stephen and Carol.
Thank you.
Hi.
And they are in Connecticut. And so let's start right off. I'm going to ask you, for someone that might not be aware, please explain the origin of needlework samplers.
Well, I guess I'll get started here. Really, about as far back as recorded history, people were trying to record patterns on fabric, so they would create decorative patterns and somehow need to preserve and record them and share them with other people. Well, that eventually, in the 1600s at least, became samplers, and they were called spot samplers back at that period of time, and really they were just relatively disorganized spot motifs on a piece of linen, usually, recording different stitches. And then around the 17th century, in England and other places, band samplers were developed, and that was a long, skinny piece of fabric, linen usually, and it was maybe 8 inches wide or something, maybe 30, 35 inches long. And those were what they called band samplers because they were just bands of motifs, different stitching techniques, mm-hmm. But not necessarily intended to be framed and displayed. Those were usually rolled up and kept in young lady's sewing bag to be pulled out as a reference for decorative stitches later.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 18th century, samplers became a little bit shorter and a little bit wider and actually more decorative to look at. And so and we deal mainly with American samplers, and so that's usually from the early 1700s to the 1840s. They went on beyond that, but after around 1840, they became a little less accomplished for the most part.
Now, did the band samplers, the width of the linen, did that have anything to do with looms at the time? Or do you know in particular?
Well, go ahead, Tony.
Yeah, it did. The longest band samplers, I think, are about 36, 38 inches long, and it was usually they're about 8 inches wide, and it would be the leftover fabric that would be used to make these, and that would be the width of the loom, you know, so they would just like cut off the end of a sheet or something that was going to be pieced together and use that. But these patterns were very important because they were the pattern that would be used for textiles, decorative pieces in the home, like curtains or cuffs or pillows. You know, so this is really took the place of a book.
I see. Now, did the tradition of the band sampler continue, or was it in the United States as well?
Well, in the States, we started off with band samplers, and the earliest known American sampler was done by Laura Standish, Miles Standish, Mayflower, his daughter, and it dates in the 1630s. So basically, it looks just like an English sampler because, of course, we were English at that time.
Right.
All the patterns came over with the English people.
Now, is that in a museum at this time?
Yes, it's at the Plymouth Hall in Plymouth, Massachusetts.
Now, as far as you just mentioned England, I know that samplers were basically in a whole different areas of the world. Is there any unusual countries that they did samplers in that you're aware of?
Well, I think samplers were made all over the world. They take different forms and, you know, decoration. But I think people always wanted to record stitching, and they always wanted to make beautiful things for homes. And I think the earliest picture of a sampler is in Barcelona, Spain. There's a painting of a group of girls showing a teacher samplers, holding them up and showing a teacher a sampler. So that goes back about 1450, and that's pretty much like the samplers that were done in England.
Really? Wow. So what type of stitches? Can you name some of the stitches? And what, why don't we just have like an anatomy of a sample? After that, if you can just tell me, like an American sampler, if you can go over what you may find on some. But first of all, what are the type of stitches that you have?
Well, people usually think of cross stitch when you think of a sampler. And a lot of, it's very, very popular today, people doing counted cross stitch. You know, it's the hottest hobby in America. And
really?
It's a lot of reproducing of old samplers and, you know, copying the same pattern into a new one. And most of that is done with cross stitch, which is the two little X's that you see. But samplers really can include a lot of different stitches, a lot of needlepoint stitches, a lot of crewel work type stitches. I mean, there's hundreds of different stitches. But it isn't the type of stitching that's done on a sampler that makes it valuable or collectible. It's really the graphic appeal, the origin, the teacher, perhaps if it's a known school. Some of the most expensive samplers in the world are only cross stitch, whereas something might have 20 different stitches on it and might be worth a fraction of that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the technique and it's not the stitching that makes something collectible or valuable. It's really the graphic appeal, the condition, the source, you know, when it was made, where, dates, and so forth.
But in general, the earlier samplers had far more complex stitches than the later samplers, although the later samplers tended to be more visual to look at, just as a decorative item.
Oh, I see. But the actual stitching itself was more complicated?
Yes.
Yeah,
generally speaking, those very early band samplers have a myriad of complex different types of stitches and very finely done. So it sort of becomes less difficult to do the samplers as the ages went on, but yet they were far more decorative to look at.
I see. Now, what spawned your interest? Did your interest in samplers happen as a couple, or did you meet each other after?
I was a nuclear reactor operator on submarines, and you can probably natural transition, you know, to dealing with steelwork.
That slides right into that.
Yeah. Many of my peers do it. No. Anyway, but actually, while doing that, Carol and I got together, and she was already involved in the antique world, so I'll let her.
Okay.
Well, my mother was a great needlewoman, so I grew up doing needlework. And being involved in antiques, you know, the natural tendency was to, you know, kind of steer toward textiles and samplers. Silk embroidery, all things that girls did at school, became, you know, very interesting to me. And then Steve and I decided, as we were dealing in antiques at one point, we said, you know, let's forget the furniture and the accessories and let's just do needlework. And that's what we've been doing for the last 30 years.
Well, I think that's a great idea to focus on one thing, become, you know, the expert on it. I have told that to a number of people over the year. If you just find something that you love, and you know, immerse yourself in it, and you know, you're known all over the world for your samplers.
Seems to be working.
Yeah, it seems to work good. That's great. Now, what would you say? Just change gears a little bit here. What would you say makes one sampler? You said earlier graphics. What are some of the other things that make a sampler rise above?
Condition is always extremely important with samplers. Condition, their graphic appeal, or even folksiness. You know, some samplers are graphically appealing, but they're not whimsical.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that are whimsical, tend to be more appealing. And then, of course, the rarity and the provenance and the historic connections and all that stuff. But the historical connections tend not to, by themselves, drive the price so much if the sampler isn't in really nice condition and pleasing to look at, because ultimately somebody that's going to be plunking down a lot of money for one of these things is going to actually be hanging it on the wall and looking at it. So it has to be pleasing to look at.
I see. Well, while we're on this subject, I had many years ago in the Portsmouth, New Hampshire area, I was in a house and they were descendants of Abigail Smith, Abigail Adams, and I saw her sampler. I cannot remember too much about it as far as the graphics or anything, because this is going back probably 20 years. But that, you know, being the first lady, you know, the second first lady of the country, wouldn't you think has a different
right.
value?
Yeah. Obviously, that, you know, packs a lot of punch.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, if there's a good association with it, if the sampler itself can't, you know, stand alone, then the history isn't as important. It's always nice to have the history, especially if it's someone well-known.
Sure.
But it's not the driving force.
Mm-hmm.
But could we backtrack a little bit? Because
sure.
I just would like to make the point that so many people think that samplers were done at home, by candlelight, you know, kneeling by mother's knee, and that's not the case at all. All of these samplers were worked in schools.
Yeah, schoolgirl samplers.
Right, and they went to school, and the teacher was the designer and taught the girls how to do the needlework. And you can often identify a sampler, the origin of it, just by looking at the composition.
I see.
Rhode Island samplers, for example, tend to be done in little bands. There might be rows of people with a big house in the middle. Pennsylvania pieces tend to be a certain size. They're bigger than New England samplers for the most part. So there are a lot of things that will tell you where a sampler is from just by looking at it.
Now, I know there was a while where people would confuse, or a time period, I should say, where people would confuse an English sampler from an American sampler. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, they still do.
They still do
quite often. And, and sometimes it's very difficult to know the difference. But usually, I mean, we've been handling these for so many years, we usually can tell the difference just by glancing at them. The English samplers, for the most part, were made, or what more often than American samplers anyway, were made with a very fine wool background. Whereas the American samplers, in general, were made with linen background.
Right.
And then there are a myriad of other subtle differences. The English samplers tended to be more uptight, more regimented, and a little less whimsical than American samplers.
The motifs tend to be a little smaller and tighter on English samplers. Also, when you look at an English sampler, if you can see the edge, the selvage, there's often a blue thread that runs through the selvage.
Really?
That fabric wasn't used very much in America.
And what was the blue thread?
Well, it's just the way it was woven, and I think they actually had a fabric called sampler cloth, and another fabric that was used for sifting flour, and they're pretty similar.
Mm-hmm.
They were used as the backing, and they're fine wool, so English samplers often tend to be peppered with little tiny holes on the back where insect infestation took place.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned a few minutes ago about doing needlework and samplers is a popular, it's like coming back, being done today.
It's the number one hobby in America and England, I believe.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So these are tomorrow's collectibles. Now, do they go just after the old styles, or are people creating different styles?
Well, there are a couple of companies, small companies, that do really accurate historic reproductions, but there are a lot of, you know, craft-type magazines and companies that do renditions, let's say, of samplers, which are nothing at all like the old ones.
I see.
Referring to your question about whether they're the samplers of tomorrow, no, they won't be, because they are done as a craft by adults for the most part, where the serious samplers that are collected now and that were done a long time ago were done by young girls in school, and they have a whole different social aspect to them compared to a modern-day craft, no matter how well it's done.
I see. Now, I've asked this in all different aspects of, and it's never even occurred to me, but, and I kind of cringe when I ask this question, but has there ever been any faked samplers?
Oh, yes.
Really?
But frankly, I mean, for us, it's easy to detect the difference.
Sure.
For someone just starting out collecting them.
The trained eye.
Mm-hmm. But there is a group of samplers going around now that, I don't know who's making them, but anyway, they're on a kind of a tea-stained cotton backing, and the letters are all herky-jerky and uneven, you know, kind of spilling all over the place. And The house might be crooked. Girls didn't make things like that. Teachers wouldn't allow it. You made your ABCs crooked. You took them out and did them over.
Right. Now, yeah, they used tea stain for all kinds of faking, it seems.
Right.
You know. But alphabets were not always in samplers. Is that right? Or was it...
Not always. I mean, the first sampler that a girl would make would be probably an alphabet sampler, and they were called marking samplers.
Mm-hmm.
They're little tiny samplers, you know, maybe 10 by 10 or maybe 5 inches high and, you know, 10 inches wide, just little pieces of fabric where the girl would practice her ABCs and her numbers. They'd put her name on the bottom, maybe a simple border, and they're just referred to as marking samplers. And this is how a girl learned her ABCs, and also she learned how to mark linens, and it was very important that you initial linens. They were sent out to the laundry. If you had 12 sheets, you wanted to make sure you got all 12 of your sheets back with your initials on, nobody else's. And then there would be a number so that the sheets could be rotated for even wear.
Mm.
So remember, when we're talking about sheets, we're talking about hand-spun, hand-woven linen, which was a huge process, you know, to make.
Sure.
So the sheets were initialed, the clothing was initialed, and this is how a girl learned how to do that, by making a little marking sampler. And then later she would go on to make a more pictorial sampler. And in the 1790s to 1830s, if she came from a wealthy family and had the means, she would go on to another school where she would work a silk embroidery, which was considered an accomplishment.
Wow. Now, we were just talking about alphabet just for a second ago. I've seen a number of samplers that will go into the ABCs and all of a sudden will end in the middle of the alphabet. Is that...
Right, where they run out of room?
Yeah.
Yeah. Plan ahead.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so I guess that was kind of a common thing, huh?
Yeah,
it was, yes.
Yeah, I see. Well, you know, I'm actually... I got to say, I'm actually shocked that they were making fake samplers, but I shouldn't be, because it just seems like anything that brings some money is fake. And, you know, across...
They really do stand out. I mean, you can't buy the materials that the girls were using, here in the 18th and 19th centuries. So the thread is different, the background is different, you know, unless you find an old piece of linen, which is pretty hard to do, and old silk to stitch with, it's pretty difficult to reproduce something like that.
Right, right. Wow. So... As far as the old samplers go, you know, I always think about how fragile and basically you're dealing with biodegradable material. And, you know, I understand, like, if a sampler's in a museum, it's going to be well-preserved with, you know, climate control and all that. And because samplers do just basically deteriorate, can you ever restore something back once it's going away?
Not normally. I mean, usually if a sampler is deteriorating because of acid getting into it and actually deteriorating the fabric, or fading from too much sunlight, or dirt that's causing problems with it, the dirt sometimes can be taken care of, but fading is never. And sometimes the acid causes chemical changes to the actual fabric, and so you can't go back. What you can do is arrest this stuff where it is by conservation mounting and proper care, you know, thereafter. But, I mean, if a sampler is conserved properly and put under UV glass with spacers and properly cared for, it should last for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So it just really they in the past have not been so well cared for. But now at this point, if anybody has a sampler and has it properly mounted, then it should be a pretty safe and stable thing, as long as it's not in too much sunlight or too much humidity.
I see. So basically, if someone has a sampler now, they should... and they want to preserve it, they should take it to someone that knows how to do archival framing and basically put it in like a hallway or somewhere that's out of light, even if they have the UV glass, right?
Right.
Absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, really, really important great samplers actually look better if they have early glass on them that doesn't necessarily have UV characteristics, but early glass with its impurities actually adds another element of interest to a sampler.
Well, even though with UV glass, they shouldn't be hung in direct sunlight.
No, of course not.
Right, right. So was it common or uncommon for a girl, let's just say this girl made this beautiful sampler, was it common for her to continue making samplers, or was it kind of limited?
Well, usually these girls made these samplers while they were young girls in school up through their late teens, depending on what period of time we're talking about. Usually after they made a simple sampler and a more complex sampler, then if it was in the early 1800s, their next project would be silk embroideries, which sometimes are memorials, sometimes are allegorical things. So if it was earlier on in the middle 1700s, they would do samplers in more complex samplers. Then they would do things that we call canvas work or tent-stitch pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So the next echelon beyond samplers. So I know this discussion is basically about samplers, but there is schoolgirl needlework out there that is an echelon beyond samplers.
Mm-hmm.
There are different types of things depending on what period we're talking about.
Yes, I saw. I was looking at your website the last few days, and I saw the number of different besides samplers that you have on your website. And while I'm speaking of that, go ahead and give your website address.
Okay, it's antiquesamplers.com.
Oh, that's pretty smart.
Easy enough.
Yes.
Samplers, plural.
Samplers, plural. Uh-huh. Now, was it a few months ago that you purchased quite a sampler? Did I hear about that?
We did. We've got a wonderful piece in August, I believe it was.
And wasn't this, correct me if I'm wrong, was that the world record price paid?
It's the record price for a sampler being sold at auction.
I see. And what was that price?
The price with buyer's commission or premium, whatever, was $465,750, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, it must have been a beauty. I know that was Kaja Veo up in Thomaston, Maine had that. I heard all about it. I heard about it after the fact, not prior to.
Oh, it's a fabulous sampler, and it's floating all around on the web, so it probably could easily be found if anybody wanted to take a look at it. Actually, we should put it on our website.
I would say.
It's gorgeous, and it's one of only three known from of that type from the Boston area. And now this is where history is sort of interesting and adds to the piece. It was done by Betsy Bentley, Elizabeth Bentley. And she was 12 years old when she made this, so it's done in 1781. And Betsy's father was one of the two men that rode Paul Revere across the river for his midnight ride.
Hmm.
That makes, a little human interest.
Sure.
And also her brother, William Bentley, Dr. William Bentley, was the very famous educator and minister in Salem, Massachusetts, and he is responsible for writing, I think it was 31 volumes of diaries that really discuss all sorts of things that were happening in Salem from about 1780 to 1820, something like that. So she's got quite a history, and I think a couple of her ancestors came over in the Mayflower, lots of good stuff. But the sampler is absolutely vibrant. It has a big black border with a floral design floating through. And in the middle, it's overall stitched with a big turkey in the middle, trees on each side, and a dog chasing a stag, leaping along the bottom. So it's got all the bells and whistles.
I love when they have the disproportionate figures.
Yes.
Like the turkey is probably five times bigger than the house or something like
that. That's right.
Yeah.
About the same size as the tree. Actually, I can see it from where I'm sitting. It's curious.
Now, did you have a customer in mind when you bought this?
We did, actually. Uh-huh. Although when we actually bought it, we were on our own. So, but
we've sold it since.
It has been sold since.
That's always good.
Yeah.
Wow, boy, I can't wait to see that. That's very interesting. So when this when this sampler came up, were you able to follow the history of where it has been?
Actually, the consigner has a pretty complete history of how it came down in the family. And they were in the audience, by the way, at the auction.
Oh, wow.
Really, really happy.
Yeah, oh, I'm sure.
The estimate on the sampler was 40,000 to 60,000, so for it to go, you know, 460-something hundred, I mean, 8,000, they were pretty excited.
And, you know, you had underbidders, so...
Oh, yeah.
Actually, in this case, it was the Boston Museum of Fine Arts.
Oh. Wow, they had pretty deep pockets. That's not...
Yes, they
always
did.
The case for museums when they're bidding a lot of times, but these days, I mean, anyway. So you bought this sampler, and so do you think there'll ever be one to match that? Or do you think this is the best?
So far, there's only three. In 1922, Bolton and Co., their American Samplers book, they have one by Suki Makepeace. And the whereabouts of that are, you know, it's unknown. Nobody knows where it went after the book. And then we had purchased one other time. But those are the only three that with that design that are known.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. So, but there was probably more around. I mean, what you were talking about earlier is the school marm or the teacher teaching the children, they have similar compositions. So there may be more out there. Just
sure,
unknown.
They're always popping up.
Oh, yeah. Wow, that's...
Sure to call us if you find one.
Well, speaking of that, I'm out in California. You're back in... Is it state... Where are you? What town are you in Connecticut?
We're in Old Saybrook, Connecticut.
Okay. But it's rare for a sampler to show up on the West Coast, but I know there was one that went for a good amount of change a couple of years ago. Out here, did you hear? You must have heard about that. It was over at Auctions by the Bay, I believe.
Yeah, I think we bought that.
You bought that?
Yes, but something else really important came up in California, and that was an overmantle at Bonhams and Butterfield several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was really exciting because those are very, very rare.
So you're saying overmantle is like a horizontal band?
Yes,
it's a 10-stitch picture, like I referred to earlier.
Like a needlepoint picture.
I see. Okay.
And quite large, maybe 4 feet wide or 5 feet wide and about 2 feet high.
Now, did you buy that as well?
Yes,
we did.
Wow. So let's talk about the novice collector because, well, for one thing, you talked earlier about this being a real popular hobby. So I'm wondering, you know, maybe there's more awareness. How would a novice collector begin? And before you start telling me, I usually tell people, you know, you always see collectors as they start collecting, they refine their collection and start, you know, weeding out, say, ones that aren't so good. When it comes to paintings and things like that, I kind of tell, you know, people, oh, you know, you're much better off spending more money on a good painting. Let's say we're talking about paintings.
Yes, you want to go for quality, not quantity.
Yeah, don't buy 10 so-so paintings. Buy one great painting. So
that's the same thing, of course, holds with samplers. It's always better to buy fewer and better. You're always happier with them. And they're more prudent investments than buying quantities of mediocre stuff.
Right. So a novice collector wants to begin. What would you give them for advice?
Oftentimes when people start collecting, they start with English pieces because you can get a lot of bang for your buck. You know, you can get something very graphic and it's not going to be as expensive as an American piece.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. They don't usually go up in value, increase in value as quickly as American things do. But you can get very nice English pieces for less money than you can an American piece. But if you're focus is going to be American, you should probably start out with American and forget that first step of buying something less expensive in the English manner. But you can start with marking samplers, or you can save your pennies and get something a little more graphic. Marking samplers were $300 30 years ago, and that's still what they are. I mean, they just don't go anyplace. You're buying mediocrity.
The common denominator, basically, is if you're a novice, if it's pleasing to look at from across the room,
mm-hmm.
and it's an American sampler, and it's before around 1840, then it's probably, you know, if it's not $1 zillion, it's probably a prudent thing to go after. But if you're making all sorts of excuses to yourself, like, well, it's hard to read, or it's not all that pretty, but it's really old, so it must be important, then you're starting to make mistakes.
Sure, sure. Now, you said 1840. Why'd you come up with that date?
Well, it's generally speaking, obviously there are a few exceptions, but generally speaking, after around 1840, the samplers started becoming, they started using wool instead of silk yarn, and the stitches started becoming bigger, and they're clunkier, and they're just a degraded form of early needlework. So they just, the samplers are just much finer in general before about that period, and then they started going downhill from there.
Uh-huh. You know, I when I think of samplers, I think of this situation, oh, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago I did an on-site auction in Acton, Massachusetts, and it was the Sanderson estate, and they had been in it was a farmhouse in the family for 5 or 6 generations, and we were taking things out. It was, like I say, it was an on-site auction, and taking things out the day before the auction, and one of the people that worked for me all of a sudden discovered all these samplers that were rolled up. They were never exposed, and they were early samplers.
Wow,
and
that's
so,
a nice find.
Yeah, and I don't know why they were never framed. And I said to the family, I says, you know, these have some pretty good value. I'd like to hold them, and you know, for another auction, advertise them. And they said, no, this, you know, they needed to split up, you know, finances. So they said, just sell them. And luckily, I'm trying to remember who it was from Nantucket, well-known dealer, was there, and a few other dealers were there, and they got right on them. I mean, they brought all the money, luckily,
right.
But it could have been a disaster, you know, where someone could have gotten a really good deal on.
Right. Well, that's good.
Do you ever hear of any finds like that?
We've heard of a lot of finds, but normally we're the second one in the list.
They come to you afterwards.
And they say, you know, what's this worth? We say, well, $1 zillion. They say, that's cute, because we paid $3 for it yesterday someplace.
$3. Yeah. Now, has anyone ever found their, like, long-lost ancestor that you wear? You know,
they have several times.
Wow.
That, which is really exciting to
that is.
Back in the family.
That is great. And I wonder sometimes how they get out of the family to begin with.
Well, quite often somebody is just the last in the line of a family, or else it gets handed down through marriage, and by the time a few hundred years have passed, maybe they're still, quote, in the family, but they're so far removed from the sampler maker that it's not important sometimes to them.
Right, but also, I mean, the prices that some of these samplers bring, it's a lot of money and also
sure.
a lot of responsibility.
Yes.
So somebody says, you know, this will put my kids through college,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we don't really like it. It was just given to us, you know, because it's a family piece. Then it makes more sense maybe to place it someplace where it will be appreciated and preserved.
You know, I hear that so much in so many different segments of the business. It's like
sure.
People saying, oh, I don't like it. You know, I mean, you know, it's my family stuff, but I don't like it. I hear it. It's almost like a broken record. It just seems like there's not like in different segments. I'm not talking about what you do, but in different segments of what we do, a lot of people.
Across the board with antiques.
You think, yeah, people are just, you know, it has the IKEA mentality of people are looking for, you know, something new and different, and they don't have a single bit of interest in what their ancestors had.
It's surprising sometimes. Sometimes samplers took the form of family records, too, and there's so much information on a family record,
right.
genealogical information, and sometimes that's the only place it is. You do all the research you can, and you find that there's just a smattering of that information available other than on the family record you're looking at in front of you. And so that's kind of a nice thing to get those back in the families.
So they're...
it just creates a better record of who was in the family, you know, than is available in any other source.
Right. I've seen a few of those. Are they called genealogy samplers?
They're called family records or family registers.
Oh, I see. And the ones that I remember seeing are up where the verse is usually, it will have like a single line and have family names. Is that how a lot of them are, or was that just the one I saw?
Yeah, oftentimes it'll say family record at the top and then have the parents' name and the dates of their births and then the marriage date and then their children, you know, births and deaths.
And then sometimes they're in the form of a, I guess, apple tree or something anyway, a
tree of life.
A tree. Mm-hmm. And then all the fruits hanging on the tree have different names, and they're connected in a sensible way.
Oh, right. I've seen. I know exactly what you mean. So I can't understand how that would ever go out of someone's family, unless, like you said, it's the last of the lineage.
Right. We had an interesting experience recently. We advertised this family record, and it was done in all over Needlepoint, and it had lots and lots of names on it and so forth. And this woman called, and she said, "That is my family." Oh. And, you know, we had it on, I guess, on our website. She said, "That's my family." And oddly enough, I just did a family register with all of those names on it.
Oh, God. That was a lot of extra work. Did she?
Yeah, wasn't that great? So anyway, it's back in her family now.
She did buy it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it does have a good ending, the story.
Well, first, we sold it for just what we paid for it.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
Get it into the family, but that's okay. I mean, it really
that's
is where it belongs, you know?
Yeah, yeah. There's so many great stories. Do you have any like, real fascinating story like that, another thing that comes to mind?
No, but one time we had a canvas work piece that was just a small piece, and we didn't think too much about it. It wasn't very interesting. It wasn't one of the best pieces we've ever had. And we sold it very inexpensively, and shortly thereafter, we opened the book, and here was a picture of the piece, and it had belonged to John Quincy Adams.
Oh, ooh.
Whoops.
And how did someone, so you sold it, and they found some extra?
No, they didn't know that. We found that information after the fact.
Ah, well, those things happen.
Yeah. But that's okay.
Can't catch them all.
Normally, we do a tremendous amount of research on pieces before we buy them, you know, but, you know, obviously things, we learn stuff about things after we sell them, too. But
mm-hmm.
Yeah, speaking of learning about things, if anyone is really interested in samplers and wants to have to read about them and get, you know, started looking at different types, Betty Ring's book, Girlhood Embroidery, is a tremendous reference.
Betty Ring.
Betty Ring, R-I-N-G.
And it's, say the title again, please.
Girlhood Embroidery.
Girlhood Embroidery. Okay. And you have a book.
We have a book. We wrote a book, How to Compare and Value Samplers. It's one of the Miller series.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think people have found that helpful. It's, you know, not a large book like Betty's, but it's a good source.
And that's on Amazon, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's out of print. You can get it on, you know, Amazon. A book dealer or whatever.
Or we have a few copies, not too many. And the same with Betty Ring's book, if anybody's looking for one. I mean, we have them available, a few, on our website, but
mm-hmm.
you can also just go out there and see what you can come up with.
Yes, I have a book on American samplers, and I can't remember. I've had it for years. I can't remember who did that. But it's just on American samplers. But I do remember it did have a lot of reference to the English, you know, in there. Textiles, in general, have, with the exception of what you do, have gone down. In general, there's statistics that at auction, textiles are down like 65% in the last 10 years. Or there's some, I may be wrong on that, but there's something I read that shows some overall auction records over the last 10 years.
Just throwing samplers and silk embroideries and canvas work pictures into the textile field.
Right.
I mean, they are textiles, in fact, but they are actually framed
artwork. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that textiles encompasses quilts and rugs.
It does.
You know, all sorts of things. So.
Yeah, the rugs have really plummeted for the most part. There's
right. But the thing different about schoolgirl needlework is they were not done professionally. They're not
right.
a commercial product that was made to sell, where most other textiles, although there are some exceptions with quilts, but most other textiles are made by adult people as manufacturing them basically by hand, but manufacturing them for the purpose of selling. And it has a whole different social connotation, and those things, like many other antique items, will tend to fluctuate a little bit. But this particular little niche seems to keep just going up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's good for you, actually.
It is.
Yeah. I think, unless you can think of anything else, I think that is all the questions that I have thought to ask you. I've had a really enjoyable talk with you. And again, if you your website one more time is
antiquesamplers.com.
Antiquesamplers.com. Well, it has been great. I really appreciate it. And I hope to talk to you too soon, and keep hunting out there.
Okay.
We'll do that. Martin, thank you for calling us. We appreciate it too.
Certainly.
Okay, thanks.
Bye. Okay, sure. Take care.
Bye.
So that was Stephen and Carol Huber back in Connecticut. And they are the premier dealers of needlework, not just samplers. And please do check out their website. That was great. Just in closing, some of the verses, I was looking at a couple of different verses that were found on samplers. And a lot of them were pious verses, but here's a couple that are one here from an 1816 American sampler. Let the mind your noblest thoughts engage, its beauties last beyond the flight of ages. Interesting. And I like this one right here. It's, this needlework of mine was taught not to spend my time for naught. In other words, keep working. So that was from a 1789 sampler. Well, I hope you enjoyed this segment. And in the next segment, Phyllis will be back with me. And so keep on listening. We're on iTunes. So if you find us on iTunes and not on our website is antiqueauctionpodcast.com. Email address, auctionpodcast@me.com. This is Martin Willis, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Signing off.